Does anyone else join the call in the last minute or two? Okay, well, it's about 7:05, so Craig had mentioned that he probably wouldn't be able to make it till later, so I'm going to go ahead and start without our secretary, and if anybody would like to fill in as secretary, they're welcome to. Otherwise, I'll just kind of keep up with things until Craig can get here, assuming he can make it later. Okay, the first thing that we always do at our teleconference is approve the minutes of the previous meeting. Craig dutifully circulated those. Oh, I'm sorry, I should announce that this is the 9/11 Truth teleconference for October 30, 2013, Ken Freeland facilitating. So the first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes as posted by Craig and circulated. Does anybody have an amendment for the minutes as circulated? Hearing none, then we'll take those minutes as approved and move on to tonight's agenda.
Does I think you want to go through the list of people first on the call.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, yes. Here's who I have so far. I have Elias Davidson, Lenny Mather, Sheila Casey, Dwayne Dietz, James Hufford, Paul Zaremka, Ned Delaney, and Barry Zwicker. Is there anybody on the call whose name I did not mention? Okay. I'm sure there'll be probably a few stragglers in as we're on the call.
Yes, Richard Krushnick from Boston will be joining any minute.
Okay. What's his name?
Richard Krushnick, K-R-U-S-H-N-I-C. He's also with the Boston 9/11 group.
Okay, good. Thanks for letting me know that.
I just called him on my other phone, and he said he'd be dialing up any minute.
Good deal. Okay, so then we move on to the agenda for tonight. It's circulated, the draft agenda. Does anybody have anything they wish to add or delete from the draft agenda? Okay, hearing no proposals in that regard, we'll go ahead and take the draft agenda as our agenda for this evening and proceed to the first item. And just to let you know, Elias, I put your item later because I was hoping Craig could be on the call by then, and since he had done some of the arranging on that, I was hoping he could be part of that. But if you have any time limitation, Elias, we'll take your item first while you're
here. Who are you speaking to, Ken?
To Elias
Davidson? No time.
Okay.
Yes, I have no time limitation.
Okay, very good.
No problem.
Then we'll keep it as it's set up, and that would be our first item. One moment, please. Hard wearing two hats at the same time. The first item is feedback and critique of our October 20th special teleconference with Chris Bowen. So that's just open for comment. We want to just hear briefly how people felt about that, people that weren't able to attend the call or listen to it after the fact, since it was recorded and offered in both WAVE and MP3 format for people that weren't there. But that, just to let you know, Elias, that was our first special teleconference with Christopher Bowen, and we're hoping that yours will be the second. So how do people feel about the one that we did with Chris Bowen? Anybody want to comment?
Yeah, I'll have a comment.
Who's me?
Paul. Yeah.
Anybody else?
Yeah, Paul. Sure. After Paul, I'd like to, is Barry here, make a comment.
Okay. All right. So Paul, then Barry.
And then
Dwayne. Okay.
I just want to comment, I did not ask any questions during his remarks. But there was a question lurking in my mind, and I'll just state it. I was hoping for a discussion, but the framework wasn't really conducive to a discussion. When he said that, he was basically talking about the Israeli government and the penetration of the United States and so forth and so on. And that was the basic line he was talking about. And he mentioned Michael Chernoff as a dual nationality, not a dual citizen of the United States. And he seemed to think that that is really important. I mean, actually very important for him. And the question I would have asked him if I thought it was kind of conducive to a dialogue back and forth would have been, well, if he's a dual national, that means he's got a nationality someplace else besides Israel, and that's, of course, the United States. So how do you decide that Israeli nationality is more important than the U.S. nationality? And if we got some discussion about that, then I would go on to the next step and ask the question about why nationality is very important. Why isn't something else much more important, like namely, well, whatever. I mean, simple, maybe just...
Hi there, Richard Kleshnick joining.
Okay, Richard,
Hi, Richard.
Thank you.
Hi.
Got your information from Lenny, so welcome to the call.
Thank you.
So anyway, that's if I felt like we could have a dialogue over that. I don't know if I made myself fully clear, but I'm not convinced that the issue of nationality and whether a person is Israeli national or American national or whatever is a decisive issue. That the more important issue seems to me to be elsewhere, like, for example, who is benefiting from whatever their nationality is. Okay, that's all.
Okay, Paul, then we've got Barry, Dwayne, and then myself. Go ahead. Anybody else want to be on the set?
Okay. Yeah, okay,
go ahead.
Who?
I'll go ahead. It's Barry here. The comment that I planned to make and will make, it's very simple and uncomplicated, is simply that from the various teleconferences I've participated in so far, I forget how many it is, I just thought that the one with Christopher was perhaps the best ever. It was focused on a person and from that person's perspective and research and so on, that gave a real feeling of solidity to the whole thing. And so that's just a very, I took notes compulsively during the thing. I still haven't gone over the notes to highlight what specially jumped out at me. Certainly was educative for me. And just to say two other things. One is to reinforce what I just said. I'm currently going through a backlog of clippings and periodicals and books and so on, sort of a life collection of them, and sorting out by subject. And I find that I actually have put aside quite a few articles about Israeli involvement in 9/11 and Israel's foreign policy and so on generally. And it really does deserve, it seems to me, to be more discussed than it is. I think there's a fear of being branded anti-Semitic, for instance. Now, the second thing would be then to respond to Paul. And Paul, I think I disagree with you in this sense, that nationality and talking about a cultural nationality can be very, very powerful. And those of us who live north of the USA realize how Americans, and I'm not speaking in any mean way, or personally here, I'm making a more general cultural comment, that Americans are just marinated in mythology about American exceptionalism and all the rest of it. And it's kind of noticeable to those of us who aren't American. And I think probably it's also true of Israelis, although I think there's more discussion among Israelis about there's left and right, you know, there's the kibbutz background of Israel, and there's Zionism and anti-Zionism and secular Judaism and so on. So it's actually a more differentiated society, I think, than American society, which tends to be just kind of unipolar. And I think it was Edgar Z. Friedenberg, an American who transplanted himself to Canada, a brilliant educator. And he said, being born American is like being born black or a Rockefeller. You can never overcome it. So that's the way I would disagree a bit with Paul.
Okay, that's very...
Yes, Elias.
Yeah, Elias. I'll tell you what. I'll put you on the stack. That's how we do it. We keep a speaking order. So as soon as somebody says they want to speak, we put them on the list to speak, and then we go in order. Okay. So I'll put you on the list. Dwayne is next, then me, and then I'll put you behind me. Okay.
Okay.
To speak. Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead, Dwayne.
I really did think it was an excellent teleconference, with the exception that I really wished we would have had a time limit on the questioners. The more we got into it, the more I thought that was a big mistake that we allowed some people to just go on and on. Over.
Okay. Well, let's see. I have to take some of the rap for that.
Who is speaking?
This is Ken. This is Ken speaking in my turn now.
Ken who?
Ken Freeland. We had made an arrangement, an agreement prior to the teleconference that questioners would be limited to 1 minute. And unfortunately, not everyone adhered to that, and it should have been reinforced and probably better enforced. And it wasn't, partly because one doesn't want to interrupt the natural flow of things when it seems productive. I think in one case it got pretty seriously out of hand, and I did finally intervene at that point and reorient the discussion away from debate into discussion. But it would have been helpful had more people at that time objected when anybody went past.
Are you timing it over there, Susan?
I'm sorry, I missed that point about Susan. What was that?
I'm sorry for the interruption. That was irrelevant.
Oh, okay. If you want to ever mute your phone so that you don't interrupt, *6 will mute your phone, and then *6
Thank
will
you.
Bring you back into the conversation, okay?
Okay.
Anybody
right.
can do that at any time. So in respect to what Paul is saying, we should look at the formatting of this. It's open to debate. You know, we use the format that we use, which is typical of our teleconferences. But if people think it would be more useful to open it up to more of a debate style, to allow more back and forth between two individuals, we could consider that. But I think people were concerned in the beginning, and I think rightfully so, that if we did that, not everyone would get the same opportunity to ask Chris the questions that they had and to hear his response at length. And so I think that was the focus of the call and the way we oriented. I think that for the most part it went pretty well. I was very disappointed in the interaction with who was it?
Spencer.
Yeah, that was really outside of the character of what we had agreed to, but on the other hand, he did raise some interesting points, and perhaps it wasn't totally unproductive. That's all I wanted to say. And Elias,
who was it that raised these points?
This was Ken Freeland speaking.
No, you were just saying that somebody last week raised some points that were productive.
Oh, I was saying that even though I thought that Fetzer's debate. Attempt to corral.
Are you saying that Jim Fetzer was on the call?
Yes, he was. He was on the call.
I see. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. He went on at great length debating and challenging Chris, and it steered away from the turn format. You know. So.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yep. So Elias, it's your turn to speak.
Yes, I have 2 points I would like to make. First one is that I would like to ask, because I didn't listen to Chris, what he said. The question is whether he mentioned any chain of command traced to Israel. I mean, I'm talking about chain of command in the Pentagon, because the Pentagon was involved in 9/11. So is there any chain of command going from the Pentagon to Israel? Did Chris discuss that? This was the first question. The second is just a comment. I possess a great deal of information about so-called Israeli participation in 9/11, which has not been published yet. Yet I don't believe that Israel was central in the 9/11. If it was involved, it was only as an auxiliary. Even if I have some, I myself an anti-Zionist and am a long activist for Palestinian rights, but I don't believe that any Israeli, even the most fanatic Zionist, would dare to plan 9/11 behind the backs of the Americans. This would be a suicide for Israel, in my opinion. Thank you.
I'd like to get on the stack, Richard Krushnick.
Hey, Richard. Richard, anybody else want to be on the stack?
Yeah. And yes, Ned Dillon,
Ned,
please.
Okay. And anyone else? Okay, Richard, your turn.
Elias is unquestionably correct, and the emphasis of last call's speaker on the role of Israel in the attack was an incorrect, exaggerated account of the Israeli involvement, because it's impossible on several accounts for the attack to have been anything other than orchestrated by United States officials. That is not to say that Israeli personnel did not play a prominent role. For all we know, it was entirely Israelis who set the explosives in the buildings. We don't know who did that. But in terms of the chain of command and the locus of the center of power and the impetus for the attack, it was in all cases predominantly the U.S., not the Israelis.
Okay. Ned, you're next, and then I'm going to go after you if nobody else wants to go.
Okay, yeah.
Who's this? Who's speaking?
This is Ned Delaney.
Thank you.
Okay. In reference to the importance of dual citizenship, I think what Chris was really referring to in reference to Michael Sheratov has to do with the basis and the core of the Bush administration in general. I think it's one of the first administrations that was made up of a significant number of dual American-Israeli people that had dual citizenship. And I think that's the point that Chris was really referring to and highlighting, not that necessarily the state of Israel per se and the people of Israel are responsible for 9/11. It's so easy to stereotype using terminology without getting them, narrowing things down. And I think the Zionist perspective seems to be a core issue in this, and that a lot of the people in the Bush administration had dual allegiances, I think, if anything, and other agendas. So anyway, that's the point that I'd like to make there. And then the other is pertaining to the call in general. I thought it tended to get a little out of hand and got to be a little long and fragmented towards the end. But all in all, I was very pleased with the way it turned out. Thank you.
I'd like to just reinforce what Ned said. I don't think Christopher, in answer to your question, Elias, I don't think that he pinpointed a a chain of command from the Pentagon to Israel. But on the other hand, I think what he did was show the culpability of people like Michael Chernoff and then point out their dual nationality as a precipitating issue. I think his argument is, you know, that Project of the New American Century, saw the need for this in order to launch the wars in the Middle East that have been to the benefit of Israel. So I think that's his basic argument, that Israel benefits, that Israel was complicit and the people in the U.S. government who had dual allegiance to Israel were agents in that respect. Whether they were acting directly for Israel or whether they had a dual use, a dual approach to foreign policy that blurred the line between what was in U.S. interest and what was in Israel's interest is probably a question that he would consider debatable, but I can't speak for him. That's my thought, though. Okay.
This is James. I'd like to get on the stack.
Okay. Anybody else besides James?
Paul.
Okay. Paul? Okay. Go ahead, James.
Okay. I'd just like to say that I really enjoyed the our call with Chris, and I found that, well, I really didn't realize what a likable fellow he is, how what a good representative he is for 9/11 Truth. But on the other hand, if those of you who have read Solving 9/11, his major book, should realize that he is saying basically that Israel did it all. I mean, he has the nanothermite coming from an Israeli source. He has everything done by Israel, and I guess I'm as guilty as anyone for not pressing him, because that's the only thing in his book that I saw that he actually wasn't able to document the total the total role of Israel, of the Mossad and Israelis in doing 9/11. But that's what his book says, and I found through my writing and my grassroots 9/11 grassroots articles that I get hit hard when I suggest anything else, when I suggest that it wasn't a Mossad operation. I think there's evidence that Israel and the Mossad were involved, but not that they were the commanding presence. And I just get hit hard for that. There's a certain faction that is not going to have it any other way, it seems. Richard would like to get back on stack.
Okay. You finished, James?
I think it was Ned who was arguing that the argument in the book wasn't really that Israel was, that it was an Israeli operation, but that these dual citizenship characters and the administration played key roles. But I did read the book, but I don't remember the details right now, but I came away with the impression that was more like James' impression than Ned's impression. In other words, the tone of the book was that this was an Israeli operation and that that U.S. involvement was secondary or maybe supportive or something like that. And I think the nanothermite's a good example. For all I know, the nanothermite was produced in Israel because the U.S. set up the production in Israel because it was the U.S. that had the technique of how to produce it.
But that doesn't matter.
It's irrelevant where that came from, because it was a U.S. operation, and the Israelis. Well, I think so too.
Whoa! We're not debating here. This James is floor right now, and then Paul will speak, and then Richard.
Well, I just
that was Richard
to say,
who just spoke.
Yeah.
Was Richard speaking?
Yeah, and I was interrupting to make a point. I'm sorry.
I
agree with you, except that
is this Ned?
That was what Chris said in the book, and he didn't document it. It's the only thing he really didn't document.
Is this James?
Maybe he was right. I don't know.
Okay. So James is taking his turn, and Richard is taking his turn, so then it will be Paul, and after Paul, then we're going to either have to cut this off because we're over time or take a vote to extend the time. So go ahead, Paul.
Now, I just want to make a couple of comments. Actually, one has to follow up on what we just said, and that is that his talk was clearly putting responsibility on Israeli. I mean, so it's absolutely consistent with the book. So I don't, you know, but at the same time, I really did not hear in almost any of his presentation to us documentation or evidence that 9/11 was driven by the Israeli. I mean, he talked about the power structure in Israel and in relationship to the United States, but that's not the same thing as connecting it to 9/11. So I was looking for that, and I didn't hear it. The other thing I would say, Ned, just a minor thing, but he made it kind of an important issue, which I agree with, and that is you have to make a distinction between Israeli-American citizenship and nationality, which is not the same thing. He made some effort in that, so I think we should, and his emphasis was on nationality, not citizenship. Okay, that's all I want to say.
Okay, so I think we should leave it there then. Thank you all for that feedback. Something we should consider when we plan the next special teleconference, especially in terms of maybe formatting issues that were relevant. Okay, the next question is topical discussion, the execution of John F. Kennedy and the relationship to September 11th, the implications of the Dallas Conference. Paul has asked us to put this on the agenda, so I'll ask him to lead it off, but I know there are a couple of other people here who are here specifically to speak on that, so we'll give them first dibs on the speaking roster if they want to speak.
Put Lenny on that stack. Put Lenny on that stack after Paul.
Yeah, I've got Paul, then Lenny, then Richard, if Richard wants to speak as well. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, here's why here's my interest in the question. I don't want to go back to the beginning of American history, but I want to go back to at least 1898, when some people consider that the rise of American imperialism and American takeover almost complete takeover of Cuba, and certainly the takeover of the Philippines after the resistance in both societies against us. We can go through World War One and to the Depression period, when there was a takeover attempt by some people who tried to get General Walker to lead a march on Washington to have a fascist, basically, dictatorship in the United States, which actually failed because Walker didn't agree to it. But Walker himself became highly critical of the role of the United States military in American history. So he was reflecting, I would say, the last 35 years he had lived before that when he made those statements. And so then we come up to World War II. I apologize to everybody. I'm going to skip over that for the moment, although we could talk about Roosevelt if you want. We have some noise here.
Somebody's got a lot of engine noise in the background. Please mute your phone by going *6, okay? *6 will mute.
Oh, I'm really sorry. This is Sheila. I'm so sorry. I put on the blender. I thought I was on mute. I will definitely mute it right now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yes, go ahead.
And we had during World War II, of course, the firebombing Japan, but particularly Japan. We also did it in Germany. The 100 cities in Japan were basically burned to the ground, except for Kyoto. And then we had the atomic bombs, which Truman knew nothing, absolutely nothing about it until he got into the presidency. But anyway, you know what that is. We had the Korean War. We had then a general, it's the four-star general running the United States, and then we come up to Kennedy. And now the question is, this is why I'm doing this. What does and I'm using the word execution of Kennedy rather than the word assassination, because execution refers to the fact that the state is doing it. Okay, so Kennedy gets executed by the U.S. state, and I don't think most anybody in this call would dispute that. I don't know if we can hear that. But the question is, what does that represent, and how does that connect to the subsequent three executions thereafter of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert F. Kennedy. And then that leads up to what does therefore 9/11 represent. So my question basically is, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the execution of John F. Kennedy, and the question is whether this, if that was, in some ways, of course, I will never contest that that's a seminal event, but what kind of seminal event is it? I mean, is it really a discontinuity, and is it a discontinuity in the sense of a coup d'etat kind of discontinuity, or is it a somewhat lesser, I mean, nothing is less in this discussion, but some kind of lesser discontinuity? I'll put it another way, is it kind of a flow that's not so unexpected as the result of a serious examination of U.S. history? So that's the next thing I wanted to say is, so we have this conference coming, two conferences coming up in Dallas. I only pointed out to one of them. It's by the Coalition for Political Assassinations.
Bob, not Coalition For, but Coalition On.
On.
They don't advocate it.
Yes, on political assassination.
Too bad. I gotta.
No, it's Coalition On Political Assassination.
Got it. I think it's correct in the agenda for this meeting, but what is not correct in the agenda for the meeting is the website, which actually, I did it kind of late at night, and I pulled up the 2012 agenda when, in fact, it's the 2013 year that we're living in. When Craig gets on the list, I mean, I know he's not on the call now, but when Craig gets on the call, or Ken, maybe you could pass it on to him, or I'll pass it on to him. Mm-hmm. I would like the minutes to show the correct URL so that people can decide pretty quickly whether they want to go to this Dallas meeting, which has, now it's a little bit, I'm displeased with its presentation so far, because it gives a list of names, but it doesn't really indicate who are exactly the confirmed speakers, and it certainly does not tell you what they're talking about, and it implies, because they have sessions, let's say, going from like 12:30 or 1 or whatever to 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that there's going to be a lot of speakers at the same time, and everybody can't be talking at the same time, so that means they're probably going to break down into parallel sessions in which you have to decide where you want to go and what you want to hear, and none of that is available to us to know what, you know, so I myself have not decided whether to go or not, but I at least want everybody to be exposed to the fact that it's taking place and perhaps make their own decision about whether they want to go. So that's it.
Paul, you said there was a second conference?
Oh, the second one, Lenny, what's the name of that conference, Lenny? I can't remember.
It's a corporation. It's a for-profit corporation, which itself is in contrast to COPA, which is the nonprofit Coalition on Political Assassinations. The other one is a for-profit company that's in it for the money. And their name is JFK Lancer, where Lancer was his Secret Service code name. So they've adopted the Secret Service code name as the name of their for-profit corporation, called JFK Lancer. And they hold a simultaneous conference to that of COPA at a different hotel, a different venue. Thing about the schedule that Paul referred to, where it just says JFK speakers, by contrast, later to RFK speakers, myself as a co-founder of COPA at its founding meeting in April of 94, and I can attest to the fact that the speakers are not at different workshops. They're on panels, so they take turns, and then it's open for discussion with the audience. So it's not like if the reference in the schedule, as it appears on the website, reads JFK speakers, and then at another time MLK or RFK speakers, it's not like they're occurring simultaneously in different sub meeting rooms or sub venues. It's all on the same panel at the same time at the same place.
From my point of view, that's worse.
No, but I mean in terms of panel discussions, in terms of panels. So, in other words, there's a panel that'll be comprised of half a dozen, I don't know, four, five, six speakers, after which, you know, it's open for discussion with the audience, just like this. So it's not like there's three of them here and four of them there and three of them somewhere else at the same time. The different topics of JFK, MLK, RFK, or Malcolm X, and other aspects are not, I mean, they're in one meeting space for discussion by those present, both from the panel of speakers and from the audience.
Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about, Lenny, while you have the floor?
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, I only have the floor to answer Paul's question. But,
okay. Paul, you were finished, weren't you?
Oh, no. Oh, I mean, there's a lot more can be said because I've been at this for 40-something years. My own trigger to the topic was Carl Oglesby's book in 1976 called The Yankee and Cowboy War, which itself was a product of 2 to 3 years of weekly columns in the Boston Phoenix. And Carl Oglesby, who was the last person held the title as president of Students for Democratic Society in the last year before that office was dissolved and replaced by three national secretaries, Carl was the last person whose title was president of SDS. And that was when his term expired at the end of his 1 year, from the summer of 65 to summer of 66. I joined in 67. And Carl was a major figure in, you know, I mean, when I heard him speak, I said to myself, well, now I know I'm in the right organization. And that was 1 week after I'd been to Cleveland sat in the third balcony in front of Martin Luther King, which, you know, the 2 weeks back-to-back reoriented or provided me with orientation for the rest of my life. So that I know anything about this topic and about this conference, which I am the one who brought to Paul's attention last Friday night, is because I'm a co-founder of the organization in April 94 and attended the first three meetings or conferences were in Washington. And then I've not been able to afford, since the 4 years in a row, I went to Dallas for the conference there, 96, 97, 98, 99. But I'm still socially networked with most of the principals. And it really is the research community that was well in gear well before 9/11 took place. So I come at the topic from the standpoint of arguing that it was nothing else than a coup d'etat. It was the military and so-called intelligence agencies of the United States government which overthrew the occupant of the White House. It was a military coup d'etat,
yeah,
in a nutshell, along with, you know, the CIA. It was not something else. He was not assassinated. He was executed, as Paul pointed out, is the proper terminology for what took place in the course of a military overthrow of the U.S. government, which, in fact, remains in progress to this day and to this minute, as Obama is only a front man for the very agency, as we can thank Wayne Madsen for clarification about, for the very agency that murdered his predecessor, or that is to say, executed his predecessor 9 administrations back. And we have a lot to which, you know, that we can attribute to that occurrence, not only the phenomenon of Barack Obama, but all, as Paul pointed out, Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and numerous other executions by the state of political activists, including, first of all, Fred Hampton, the Illinois Black Panther leader, shot in his sleep at age 20 while he was under sedation by, you know, prescription sleeping pills. And yet they shot him 90-something times while he was sound asleep. And all of that, you know, is amply substantiated by mountains of documentation and evidence, forensic evidence. And so Not only is it my view that, it was a military coup d'etat, which remains in force to this day in the incarnation of Barack Obama, but which explains a lot of the events ever since, but most of all, which explains 9/11. And whether irrespective of the concept of Israeli involvement, irrespective of that, 9/11 was orchestrated by the same gang who 38 years earlier orchestrated the coup d'etat in the murder of President Kennedy. And I'm ready for debate. Bring it on, as they say. I'm open up to discussion, yes. But Richard might like to chime in here.
Yeah, we've got to give Richard a shot, and then we'll take a stack for people that would like to respond. Go ahead, Richard.
What Lenny says is absolutely correct. And the back and Paul's background is also important. Now, in the Boston 9/11 Truth Group, we've had ongoing discussions and experiences and so on. I think it was from our effort, which Lenny and I led, to try and make some inroads in the liberal and Trotskyist sectarian left-led anti-war movement in the New England region. We made efforts to work with them, in particular in a conference 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
That was January 31st of 2010.
Okay.
It's been going on 4 years.
And so that was a significant learning experience.
Also attending the other conferences in Pittsburgh and Albany and Stanford.
Yeah, these are all different anti-war conferences where various 9/11 groups got together and had a presence and did activities and so on. That was one of the experiences, along with our normal experiences that every 9/11 Truth Group has and individuals have, of the difficulty of breaking through the psychological barrier, the cognitive dissonance that makes it so difficult for people to even consider with an open mind anything about 9/11 Truth. We arrived at the conclusion in our group that it was really necessary for the 9/11 Truth Movement as a whole to broaden its internal research and its external educational efforts to incorporate the entire spectrum of activities and meaning of the deep state. And only then would we be able to break through the cognitive dissonance and the psychological resistance of most people to make really, really significant headway with masses of people in this society. And while I, in a way, would go back to Pearl Harbor and World War II as the beginning of the modern deep state, because that was when military executed a 18-month plan to entice the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor and all that. That's when the psychology of deep state operations really got set. But that's, I think, too much for the public to handle. But on the other hand, the public, there's a far greater percentage of the public that's not only open to, but is relatively knowledgeable about the national security state assassinating John F. Kennedy or executing John F. Kennedy. And so that offers a much greater opening. And I think it is incumbent upon the 9/11 Truth Movement to encourage this approach everywhere that it's doing its work, except for AE 9/11 Truth, which I'll come back to, and see the coup d'etat of 1963 and 9/11 as sort of these bracketing points of the deep state,
and the two points that illuminate most clearly the significance and truth and relevance of the deep state. I have not been to one of the Dallas conferences. Under Lenny's guidance, I've been improving my understanding of the coup and other assassinations and so on.
May I just interject that Richard is referring to the deep state. Others may not be aware of the central influence of Peter Dale Scott in spelling that out for us.
Yeah.
That's all. Yeah. I'm just encouraging that most other people may not know, Richard, of what you mean.
Right, right. What the deep state is, the United States government participation in and control of the international narcotics trade, the entire spectrum of CIA coup d'etats all over the world, all of the assassinations of important and unimportant people, and most importantly of all, it is the organizational and personal relationships among the multinational corporate elite and the military and the politicians and the academics that form the deep state.
And deep politics. You're not crediting Peter Dale Scott.
Well, yeah, this is what Peter has laid this out better than anybody else. He's the person who actually coined the phrase the deep state, but also who has
politics of the
who has integrated it best in his writings. So that's why I'm going to the Dallas conference. I'd like to encourage other people involved in 9/11 Truth to go so that we can engender conversations there. It's a great opportunity because it's replete with not all, but many of the best authors about the various assassinations of JFK, RFK, and Malcolm X. I guess William Pepper's, I haven't seen him as appearing. He's the expert on the King assassination, but it's an excellent opportunity to meet face to face and learn from many of the most prominent lifelong scholars of all these key political assassinations, and an opportunity for 9/11 Truth people to kind of feel out the interest among that community of attempting to integrate our efforts, which I think over the long haul is necessary for both camps to break out of their isolation in amidst the larger population. That's it.
Yeah, it's Elias.
Before you break off, could you mention what you were going to mention about the 9/11 Truth?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just that I think it's crucial, and so does our group as a whole here in Boston. We think it's crucial that 9/11 Truth stay exactly as it is with its narrow focus on just representing the scientific evidence about what occurred on 9/11, that we need that desperately, to stay as it is, as this bulwark in the hard facts reality world. But that doesn't mean that, on the other hand, the other elements in 9/11 Truth need to do what's necessary, whatever that may be, to break through the cognitive dissonance barrier that's holding us back from reaching more of the population. And that means, doing the kind of things that Lenny and I are advocating here.
Okay. Thank you all for that input, and now we'll open the floor for people to get on the stack to respond and or ask questions or make comments. Who would like to be on the stack?
Elias.
Who else?
Yeah.
One moment, Elias. Who else besides Elias?
Well, I'll come back.
Who?
Paul, I would come
who?
Back.
All right, Paul, I'll put your name on there behind others that haven't spoken yet. I'm going to put myself behind Elias then. Go ahead, Elias.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to endorse what Richard and Lenny have said about broadening the research, including the ideas of the high, of the deep state. I'd like to endorse that. I'd like to mention two issues which should, I think, be included in that agenda. First one is the Operation Gladio, which was involving European countries.
Yeah.
Operation Gladio is not very much known in the United States. It was involved in the organization of terrorist attacks in the Cold War. It was coordinated by NATO. They engaged in terrorism, which was put into the shoes of leftist extremists. They did many terrorist acts in Italy, in Belgium, and probably in Germany too.
And Greece.
They did it for decades. So basically, we have evidence of a deep state in European countries. So in that respect, the idea of a deep state is not a specific American or U.S. phenomenon. It is known outside the United States also.
Yeah.
And there is a decision, there is a resolution by the European Parliament to establish the truth on the Gladio. So it is an open, it's not something secret. The European Parliament made a resolution concerning these kind of events, but it was not followed up. This is the first thing, and there is in fact quite a lot of literature about that. There are at least two films about Gladio which are very useful. Mm-hmm. The second point I'd like to bring up is the one of the events which in fact is quite similar to 9/11 in a small scale, in this is the sinking of USS Liberty in 1967. Mm-hmm. The Liberty was sunk by the Israelis, but at the request of the White House. So we have a cooperation between Israel and the United States to sink an American military ship. And some of the survivors are still fighting for the truth on these events. I urge you to acquaint yourself with the dossier of USS Liberty, for which there is a website, or at least one, and also extremely good book by Peter Hunam, which was a reporter for Sunday Times. And he wrote a book about the USS Liberty called Operation Cyanide, and there is also a film about it. It shows basically how the deep state operated. I think it shows it extremely well, and it is should be added to the issues like the execution of JFK and other things. Thank you.
Thank you, Elias. Well, I'd sure like to take a point from what Elias has just said about the USS Liberty, because it does represent, in my view also, a very clear analogy with 9/11, and for that matter, with the JFK assassination in this respect. You know, there are people who argue that the JFK assassination was done by Israel. The author of the book Final Judgment makes that claim, in fact. But it seems that the pattern here is full Israeli involvement in all three of these areas, but that doesn't mean Israeli planning. It doesn't mean Israeli masterminding. It means that the Israelis had agendas that meshed with the deep state's agenda, and they became co-conspirators over and over and over again. That would be my argument. Okay, looking at it from my limited understanding of history. But
Lenny wants to quick interject that the same controversy as to culpability and who is part of it is the controversy about the complicity of President Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would say, well, a lot of people insist that he was the instigator. And
right.
yet the evidence shows that the instigation of Kennedy's execution for the sake of a coup d'etat was way over LBJ's head. He went along
right.
the ride. But, I mean, there is a controversy of many people who insist LBJ was behind the whole thing.
Okay. The problem here is if too many people speak at once, we won't
this
be able to.
This is James. I'd like to get on the stack.
Yeah, I'll put you on the stack behind me.
Oh, Ken, while you're building the stack, it's Barry Zwicker here. Would you add me?
Yeah.
I meant to add myself, but I had my mute on.
Oh, okay, sure. So after I'm finished, it will be James, Barry, and then Paul. Okay.
But Lenny put that once ago.
Ken, would you put me on the stack as well? This is Sheila.
All right.
Lenny and Sheila.
All right. So I'll put Sheila behind Barry, and then it will be Paul and Lenny again. Okay. Now, I had a question of Lenny that I'd like to ask while I have the floor, and that is regarding the new JFK group, private group, and what is the origin of them, and how did they come into being?
Did you say the which group?
The private, the .com.
The Lancer.
Group. Oh, the Lancer group.
Yeah.
Historiography about both of them.
Well, I would just like to understand how the second one came into being and what you understand to be their motives. Okay, I'm just curious about that in passing.
The topic of JFK's murder is a commercial event for many of the corporate aristocracy in that city. It's a corporate event. Now, I'm not going to impugn the intellectual integrity of the woman. By the name of Deborah Conway. Deborah Conway runs the group, and there was something that involved her marital history, I forget, but it was an enterprise before it became known as JFK Lancer. Copa, I'm intimately knowledgeable of its genesis. As a co-founder in April of 94, and to a great extent, the founding of COPA derived from a four-day weekend symposium at the Harvard Law School, which I organized in November of 93 at the Harvard Law School, titled the 30th anniversary symposium on the assassination of President Kennedy years ago.
My question is really just about the other group. Why did they come into being at all? Okay.
Well, in other words, I only learned about the conferences in Dallas. Here's what I'm trying to say is that the co-founders of COPA were inspired by not only what I pulled off at the Harvard Law School, but so inspired in opposition against what had been the history of conferences in Dallas that had been sponsored by this for-profit group, and I think it somehow evolved from. I mean, I think what I think I'm trying to say is that the JFK Lancer evolved from a corporate precedent. That there had been some other for-profit enterprise, which, as opposed to the Sixth Floor Museum, and the Sixth Floor Museum is another story because that's promoting the fairy tale about Oswald. So COPA was founded not only on the basis of what I pulled off in Cambridge, but in opposition against what had been a history of conferences at which the speakers. Brought from all over the country did not hold in the highest esteem, that they'd been mistreated, that, you know, in other words, it wasn't dedicated to the research, whereas COPA is dedicated to the research. And JFK Lancer, from its prior incarnation, seemed more dedicated to how they can make a buck.
Okay.
Before you use the topic for corp, you know, for some kind of commercial exploitation, whereas the other party to all this, the Sixth Floor Museum, is in the for-profit business of promoting the fairy tale that Oswald, you know, was the culprit.
Sure.
And they make a lot of money doing it, and there's huge corporate investment in the promotion of the Sixth Floor Museum, and it so happens that for 49 years, there's been a moment of silence on the grassy knoll.
Okay, thank you very much, Lenny. I appreciate that. I just want to repeat.
I'm just saying the city of Dallas is taking it over this year. The city of Dallas spent millions of dollars to renovate Dealey Plaza to keep out anyone who disputes the fairy tale about Oswald.
Got it. Okay.
That's a huge
topic. Right. Thank you. I just wanted to reiterate my point that I was making earlier, though, respecting the relationship between the USS Liberty and 9/11. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. And the JFK assassination, for example, and 9/11. In USS Liberty, you have a complete implementation by the state of Israel using its armament, using its weaponry. It did everything from A to Z. The only question remains whether Israel acted on its own.
False flag.
Whether Israel acted on its own or whether it was acting in full complicity with LBJ, which I rather suspect it was. But that's the research that remains to be done, although some people...
No, it's not remains to be done, Ken. It has been done. And the fact of the matter is Kennedy was executed by the national security state.
No. I'm not talking about Kennedy. I'm talking about Israel. I'm talking about Liberty.
That's where the analogy breaks down, Ken. The analogy breaks down at that point.
Well, I'm just saying it's an open-ended question.
There was only one incident which entailed the seizure of state power.
Excuse me, this is getting out of order. I mean, just...
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
let me clarify how we do the teleconference here because I think there's some confusion. Whoever has the floor is allowed to speak without interruption until they're finished. Okay. That's the only way that we can keep order on the call and take turns to speak. So I know that a lot of times you have things you want to say, but the way to handle that is to say I'd like to get on the stack, and then that way others aren't deprived of their turn and speak. Okay. That's all I had to say, and then we'll go on to James, and then Barry, then Sheila, then Paul, and Lenny again. Okay, go ahead, James.
Okay, I want to make two points. One is that deep power doesn't always involve deep state, and that one example would be Project for New American Century. When they were plotting, they weren't in power, and then... And earlier, if you're looking for roots of this sort of thing or antecedents, I would suggest looking more into the plot to overthrow FDR in 1933 to make Smedley Butler the head of a fascist state in America. And that certainly wasn't from inside the government, I don't think. And I would say that would be an early instance of fascistic, you know, bankers and so on getting together and trying to pull a coup.
Richard would like to get on stack.
Hey, Richard, I'll put you behind Lenny. Okay, James, is that it?
Yeah.
Thank you. Barry, you're next.
Okay. I'm really very gratified that so many people are, as it were, connecting the dots and looking at a larger canvas, the largest canvas that we can grasp, about what forces and institutions and individuals are behind these history-changing events. Assassinations, false flag operations, and so on. And so I'd just like to, I'm not going to speak for long, but I'd like to pick up where Elias left off. I'm very glad that he mentioned Operation Gladio, and, you know, I've read that book and been in touch with its author, Gantzer. And what I think I'm seeing in the world today is an expansion of the strategy of tension, which is really rule by fear and to disrupt and confuse and cause chaos. I'm seeing that expanded to the global level. And you look at Libya, you look at Syria, and so on, and Iraq. These societies have been disrupted horribly, and sectarian violence has been encouraged, and I would say in many cases, if not most cases, masterminded in all these bombings of mosques and markets and so on. Who is benefiting from this? There has to be the same kind of hidden hand behind it that was behind Operation Gladio and the so-called Stay Behind armies.
Right on.
There's a word in Turkey has had a very deep state too, and fortunately it has been revealed to some considerable extent, and a whole lot of the military people and journalists who have been involved with it are now under charge and have been found guilty in many cases, and some of them are in the slammer, and that doesn't get too much ink here in the West. So that's one thing. And now going on from that, is the connections that are being made, which I'm again gratified to see, back into the history, and I want to recommend really finally three pieces of work. Two of them are books by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M. Some people may be aware of Charles Higham. He was a New York Times correspondent for 24 years or so, working on the West Coast. And mainly he was interested
in... Spell his last name again.
H-I-G-H-A-M, Higham, first name Charles. And he wrote the first book of his that I read, because it was probably his 30th book, but he wrote mainly biographies of Hollywood stars. And that's how he got political, actually. He did a biography that had political connections. And so his first book, at least that I read, is called Trading with the Enemy. And it's about the collusion of the American corporate elite and establishment with Hitler throughout the Second World War. It's fulsomely sourced. No one ever... tried to sue Charles Higham for that book. It's a very compelling book that shows us gives us a new view of what went on in World War II. I've come away with the conclusion that World War II could ended 2 years before it did, but there were too many people profiting from it. And in this connection, I'll just refer briefly to LBJ, who's been mentioned here. And there's a quote some of you may have heard where LBJ, when he was in power and the Vietnam War was raging, and he was approached by someone in the White House who said to him, I'm paraphrasing all this, you know, you can actually stop this war. You can wind it down. And he said, no, I can't. And the aide said, yes, you can. You know, you have the power. You can start the wheels turning to wind this down. And LBJ replied, no, I can't, because my friends are making too much money. And that really goes to the heart of a lot of this. The other book by Charles Higham is called American Swastika. And that's where you can read a whole chapter on the plans to abduct FDR and so on. Now, the final recommendation I want to make, which I think is very much in line with this whole teleconference, I've sent by email to Ken the URL where you can access this. And what this is a paper which I've had printed here in Toronto. It comes out to 68 pages, entitled The Moral Decoding of 9/11 Beyond the U.S. Criminal State, and it's by John McMurtry. Now, John McMurtry is a philosopher at the University of Guelph, and I'm going to just ask you to bear with me while I read about 200 words here, just from page 10. They're virtually selected at random, because this gives some idea of the richness and the depth of the analysis that John McMurtry makes, where he connects so many dots. The subhead is Unraveling the Supreme Moral Doctrine Behind the U.S. Covert State. And it reads, the genocide of Iraq as the long opposing evil empire was in free fall is the most important strategic anchoring prior to 9/11. covert strategic policy to forward the supreme goal is by now self-evident, but the inner moral logic is assumed and not penetrated. The most influential of Rockefeller's proteges in this regard is the philosopher king of the U.S. covert state, Leo Strauss. And remember here that McMurtry is speaking as a philosopher. While he never worked in a philosophy department or has had any training in logic, his concept of natural right fits exactly the supranational sovereignty of private money sequence rule of the world. What the intellectual elite, Rockefeller, refers to invoke as moral anchor and justice. The moral thought system is not unlike that of Mein Kampf, without the racist rant. Camouflaged everywhere in practice by the method of big lies, noble lies, as Strauss exalts them. The innermost value driver is a perpetual war of dispossession of the weaker for the private transnational money capital multiplication of the rich. Nothing in this doctrine is too mendacious, greed-crazed, or murderous. If it fulfills the plan of this limitless private capital rule as ultimate moral ground and compass. In Strauss's canonical teaching of U.S. national security advisors and their intellectual following, the ruling moral absolute is expressed by the core master idea behind the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and bankers, namely, limitless capital accumulation is the highest right and moral duty, and might have added, of the deep state. And the final sentence that I'll just choose to quote here, this is the ethical absolute of the covert U.S. state and its strategic decision structure. And there is no internal limit within this moral universe to seize life means from poorer societies and resource looting for the supreme goal. And this is just a fragment of the rich and important intellectual work that John McMurtry has done in this paper, The Moral Decoding of 9/11. And it's on the Global Research website, but as I said, I sent the URL for it to Ken, and unless people object, Ken could send out that URL to all of you, and you could check it out for yourself.
Yeah. Any objection to that? Okay. We'll do that. Okay.
By URL, Perry means URL.
We've had extensive discussion about the work of John McMurtry before, and I think we're all pretty impressed by it.
The work by who?
McMurtry.
He's on a show with Peter Dale Scott. He's in the same caliber.
Yeah. Okay, so we have one more speaker who hasn't spoken. That's Sheila, and then three speakers that want to speak again. Go ahead, Sheila.
Yeah, hi. I want to explain that and apologize about that noise because I usually have mine on my phone on mute, but when I switch back and forth between, I didn't realize that when I go off of back and forth between speaker and using the handset that it takes off the mute, so that's why I didn't know. Anyway, sorry about that.
Well, you sort of blended in, Sheila.
That's okay. Well, I have one of these like $500 blenders, so it sounds like a jet engine when it takes off. And I want to really thank Barry for this reference to John McMurtry. I've already called it up on the Global Research website. It looks very interesting, and I will definitely read that. It sounds really good. And wanted to say about the whole discussion about to what degree is Israel responsible versus the United States, that I kind of think it's not a real question because I don't believe that the people who are really our fascist overlords are primarily coming from any kind of patriotic interest, and I think they're internationalists. And there are many international groups, such as the Bilderberg Group, which meet regularly and conspire on various ways to further degrade us, kill us, destroy us. And I don't think that their allegiance is to any one nation. So it probably is, ultimately a you know, kind of going down a dark alley to try to allocate guilt decisively to one government or another. So I think there are, you know, many actors involved and who have all different kinds of connections at high levels, especially now with, as Barry was just pointing out, the ultimate goal is limitless accumulation of capital, and the multinational corporations have learned that they can spread their, you know, spread their operations around the world and avoid actually having to abide by the laws of any one country. So it's more true now than it was ever. And I also want to say thank you to the man who's been speaking about, the man who, I think it was Lenny, who has the extensive background in the whole JFK issue. And, you know, thank you for your comments on that. That's not something I have researched extensively, although I am curious to know more about it. So it's just wanted to thank him for what he had to say on that. That's it.
Great. Thank you, Sheila. Before we continue, we are pretty far over time on this issue, and we do need to deal before we leave with setting up the Elias Davidson special teleconference. So I'd ask Paul and Lenny and Richard to please keep your comments brief and just, you know, wrap up what you have to say, okay? Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, just two things. One is I'm glad Sheila said what she just said. Not necessarily about the Bilderberg, but the very idea of this thing goes beyond a national, quote-unquote, national interest. That was basically the point I was trying to raise earlier this evening. The other thing I wanted to say is that Lenny used the word coup d'etat in 1963, but he didn't support why that particular word is applicable, which means that he has to somehow show that that is a specific characteristic of a discontinuity distinct from others. For example, the possibility that, let's just take an example, that Fletcher Prouty has mentioned the fact that he witnessed some discussion to the effect that Roosevelt was poisoned. To go back to American history before the Civil War, there's three presidents, two of whom looked like they were poisoned, and there was a third one which was attempted to be poisoned, but it failed. And there was, of course, the Lincoln assassination. So we've got a real history here in the United States, and I'm not quite sure. Maybe we had a military coup from the get-go from Washington. I don't know what we want to say, but I'm not convinced that the word military coup begins on November 22nd, 1963.
Is it my turn?
Lenny, go ahead.
It's my turn now.
Lenny?
Yeah, it's my turn.
Yes.
Well, I would argue that from what has been well documented by, among other scholars, Jim Douglas, in his recent book published 5 years ago, republished 3 years later, and about to be republished a third time next month for the 50th. Jim Douglas documents in such great depth and detail that, as Peter Dale Scott has also, from a different angle, that not only were military personnel front and center, but that all this entailed the conflict between the White House, embodied by President Kennedy, and the CIA in the immediate aftermath of, well, barely a few months after his inauguration in January of 61, he was immediately set upon by the forces of defeated opposition in that 1960 election in the person of Richard Nixon. It so happens that Richard Nixon had been delegated by President Eisenhower to oversee what they called the 40 Committee as a liaison to network, you know, and coordinate between the White House and the CIA, and put Vice President Richard Nixon in charge of it. Well, the first two tasks with which Nixon was confronted, Vice President Nixon, was the overthrow of the government of Indonesia and the reversal of the ascendancy of the Cuban Revolution. and Nixon was put in charge of it. And among his lieutenants and one of his major, collaborators on the 40 Committee, I don't know why they called it 40 Committee, it might have been because there were 40 of them, but the object of this committee delegated by Eisenhower to reverse the Cuban Revolution and overthrow the government, even if in the form of assassination, of the only president since the independence of Indonesia in 1945, Ahmed Sukarno. And each time it failed, and then Nixon was defeated. But that doesn't mean that in his liaison with the CIA that he was out of sight, out of mind. When the CIA went back in 1965 under President Johnson to overthrow, and intending not to fail in this third attempt, the government of Indonesia, they could not have done that except by the predicate of the coup d'etat that occurred 2 years before the overthrow of the Indonesian government. The elimination of President Kennedy was the sine qua non, without which there could not have been a reversal of his instruction for withdrawal from Vietnam, dated October 11, 1963, and the reversal of his support for President Sukarno of Indonesia. His elimination was the predicate for the success, third time around, of the coup d'etat and the overthrow and the genocide, as Wayne Madsen brings to the table the discussion about the role of the Ford Foundation and the CIA in the employment of Barack Obama's mother, and especially her Indonesian second husband, was an executioner for the Indonesian military. And that's what enabled the cross of his childhood in Jakarta. And that's why he's president. Not because of the voters, but the CIA installed Barack Obama into his office. He was born into the milieu of the CIA and the practice of mass murder.
Okay, Lenny, I'm going to have to cut you off there. I realize this is a very deep subject. We could go on into it indefinitely.
Yes, I'm just emphasizing like to debate with Paul, if he'd like to debate with me, on the documentation of, as I've described it, nothing else but a military takeover. And when they realized the need for preventing implementation of a deviant program and a deviant agenda, and that's why he had to go, to prevent his deviation from their agenda.
Well, because I would like to hear that debate too, I would like to suggest that somebody put it on the agenda for the next teleconference and we spend a considerable amount of time on just that question.
Yes, okay. I'm all for that. But the last thing is to say that none of this would be on the fort, that is, on the front burner, were it not for the fact that it's also now the 50th anniversary of all the above. And so it's culminating in Dallas right now. And that's what was the reason we tried to put the right, as Barry says, Earl, URL, on the posting for the agenda that it's the conference, the organization's website of the organization, COPA, is politicalassassinations.com.
Okay. Thank you, Lenny. Richard, please try to keep it brief, okay? Thank you.
Okay. I've read everything that everybody's talked about, and I agree with everything that everybody said. But while I believe that we must do the best we can to figure out how to educate people about the entire spectrum, the entire history of the deep state, and what it means, I think that thinking strategically, how do we do this? You know, how do we go about such an unbelievable project? And that's why I come back to the coup of 1963, because that's our best foothold. You know, we can go backwards to Gladio and to other things, and go forward from that to all kinds of false flag operations and deep state operations and coups and so on. All of them are important, in their own way, and they enlighten, you know, in various ways. But our best foothold, our best anchor, toward broadening 9/11 truth into a broader educational focus, A, and B, the people to do it with. You know, our best anchor is the COPA people and the large sector of the population in the United States that knows a fair amount about the execution of JFK. That's a place that I think we should figure out how can we communicate with, ally with those people, and try to get them to broaden their message, you know, from the assassinations to incorporate 9/11 and subsequent events. And, you know, but that's why I think that the Dallas conference is important for 9/11 truth people to attend, and why I think that's the best starting point for us to expand our educational efforts to the spectrum of the deep state.
Thank you, Richard. What are the dates of that conference again?
It begins on Thursday, October 21st.
November 21st.
That's what I say, October.
Yeah.
Thursday, November 21st. Through Sunday, November 24th. It so happens that coincidence this year, the luck of the draw, is that the 22nd happens to be on a Friday, as it was 50 years ago.
Okay, so that will have.
Now let me add one thing. I'm set. I'm going, and I can pay. But we're trying to raise money to get a few other 9/11 truth related people down there if anybody's into donating any money.
Okay, well, we'll make a note of that in the minutes. Maybe do you want to give us Cindy your email address, and I'll ask people if they want to donate to let you know?
Lenny is Gitche Gumi for the Lake Superior, GitcheGumi@earthlink.net. Gitche Gumi with two pairs of E's. GitcheGumi@earthlink.net.
Okay, and while we're on the subject, Lenny, are you? This is Lenny speaking, right?
I am. I confess.
Yeah. Okay. Are you on our mailing list right now? Are you getting our
yes.
The teleconferences?
Oh, this is not the first. This is not the first conference I've been in.
I know, but I want to make sure that you're on the mailing list. Are you getting...
Well, I already know the schedule because I get the mail from you.
Okay.
Well, I wouldn't have been knowing the access code to give Richard so we could both be on the call, except I'm on the list.
Okay. Well, how about you, Richard? Are you on our list? Are you getting
yes.
our... Okay. And Elias, are you on our list? Do you get our regular draft agendas in minutes? Pardon?
I'm getting information now from...
You're getting information from where?
Paul.
Oh, I know, but I want to know if you want to be on the regular mailing list to get our announcements
sure.
from the teleconferences. Okay.
Sure. I will get it to Paul.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Now, let's move on to our last agenda item, which is very important, which is setting up for the special conference call with Elias Davidson. I would assume that this conference call, if we can get it dated and set up, will follow approximately the same format as the last, which would be that Elias would give us a brief summary of his work and his particularly any recent things that he's been researching, and then we would open it up for questions from people that are on the call and the opportunity to get responses from Elias. Does that seem reasonable to you, Elias? Would that be a workable format for you?
It's very good with me. It's okay.
Okay, fine. So unless anybody has a better suggestion, that would be our thought on how we would proceed, assuming that we would keep the same limitation and try to enforce it more strictly this time, which is that each questioner would be limited to 1 minute per question, and we would take turns asking questions. Again, I would ask people to register for the conference, and that way we would have a speaking order from the very beginning. People would be in the speaking order, in the order in which they registered. So if that's all agreeable to everybody, we need to look at dates. Does anybody have any objection to any of the foregoing?
Well, I don't have an objection. This is Paul. I don't have an objection, but I think it might be better to try and, let's say, have the first discussion limited to an hour and a half, and then have at least a half hour of discussion, kind of, not just
a live. More open discussion? Okay.
Yeah.
Would that be agreeable to you, Elias, if we had an opportunity for people to ask you questions, and then we open it up for more open discussion?
Any format that you decide is okay with me.
Okay. And is 2 hours not pushing it for you? Would that be agreeable to you? If the whole thing took that long? Okay. All right. So then that sounds like we've got a plan. We'll remember that in the formatting. We need to look at dates. So are there any proposals for dates? Does anybody have anything in particular in mind? Elias, is there any? What we did last time was we did it on a Sunday. It would have been a Sunday morning / afternoon our time. So it would be what your time? It'd probably be like later in the evening in your time. How far behind Eastern time are you, Elias? Do you know?
5 hours.
You're 5 hours off. Okay, so the one we did here with Christopher, we did it at 11. Pacific. No.
No, 1 p.m.
1 p.m. Pacific. 10 a.m.
1 p.m.
Was it 10?
1 p.m.
1 p.m. Eastern. Thank you. Okay, so it's 1 p.m. Eastern. So then it would be like 6 o'clock your time, p.m. Would that be agreeable to you?
Very good time for me.
Okay. Okay. So then, we just need a date. On which we could do that. We were thinking Saturdays to Sundays seemed to be working pretty well.
I'm practically free.
You're relatively free. Okay. Does anybody have any blackout dates that's on this call? Any dates that would not work for you on a Saturday or Sunday in November?
Yeah, not the weekend of Dallas Conference.
Of course. Yeah, very good. So that we know that that's the 21st to the 24th. So that, well, that's when, oh, sorry, I'm looking in October. That would be that third weekend. Okay, so how about if we back it up to the weekend before that, and let's try it on a Sunday again, Sunday afternoon. Does that seem workable for everyone, the 17th of November?
Excellent.
Okay, done deal. And so we'll plan on meeting with Elias, and we'll send that announcement out well in advance so people can register for that, and we'll get a speaking order, and look forward to seeing Elias then. Thank you so much for showing up on the call, Elias. It facilitates very much our planning when you're right here to double check with. So that's excellent. Thank you all for your participation tonight and the cooperation, and we'll look forward to seeing you the last weekend of November. And remember, if you have any agenda items, just submit them to me in advance so that we can get them on the agenda. Anybody can propose one at any time, okay? Craig never made it. No. He said he might not make it, so that's just the way it went. But I've got the notes, so the minutes will go out one way or the other, okay?
Okay. Use the correct URL, okay? The tiny URL?
Oh, the tiny URL, yes. tinyurl.com/CopaDallas. Uppercase, the abbreviation of the organization, COPA. So the whole thing is tinyurl.com/COPA, uppercase, and then uppercase D for Dallas, and the rest of the name of Dallas. COPA Dallas, COPADALLAS. Is all there is that follows the slash after tinyurl.com.
Okay.
But I could give you other addresses. I've got a half a dozen of them at least memorized that are really key to this whole thing. Can I just have 5 minutes?
Well, what you can do is email them to me and Craig for inclusion in the minutes, and then it will go out to everybody, okay?
That's my deadline.
Anytime over the week, by the weekend, by this weekend.
I'll do my best.
Well, you said you wanted to get some addresses out. Right?
Well, I mean, there's valuable links and resources about all of this,
yeah.
At least on a par with, if not exceeding, the best research about 9/11.
Okay, well, whatever you send with respect to this, we will include it in the minutes for people's reference, okay?
And I need to get that to you by, shall we say, Monday?
No, well, it's by Sunday, okay? Just to be on the safe side.
All right,
Sunday night, okay?
All right. Mail me your email.
Okay.
By the way, mail me your... In fact, you know, Ken, before you go, Ken.
Yeah.
Email me your phone number.
Okay, now that's at Gitchigumi
at earthlink.net.
Let me make sure I got that spelled right. G-I-T-G-C-H-E-E.
Wait, start over again. Start over.
G-I-T-C-H-E-E. Right?
Yes, so far.
G-U-M-E-E.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
At earthlink.net.
Exactly. And here's my phone, and I'd like if you gave me yours.
All right.
Do we need to go offline to do that, or you want? Why don't you? My phone is 857. You got that?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead again. Somebody just dropped off the call. Go ahead.
All right, 857.
Mhm.
523.
Mhm.
9606.
9606.
Yes.
Okay.
And mind you, I'm a veteran of SDS from 1967.
Well, I was an SDS myself, so...
No kidding,
yeah,
where were you at?
University of Toledo, Toledo, Ohio.
Oh, I was at Michigan State, just a few miles
out
from Toledo.
Yeah, you're up there in Adrian, huh?
Yeah, I was born in East Lansing.
Oh, East Lansing, I'm sorry, yeah.
I've been in Boston
for 43 years. I'm leaving.
Yeah, so we're done, Elias. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, so you have my phone, so here, quickly, give me your... Because I was upset a little bit with Paul. I mean, not with Paul, but that he had no phone number access to make the correction of the address. He sent a wrong address in the link that you...
Yeah, well, he tried to correct it, but I didn't catch the correction in time, and that's not what happened. Yeah.
So you've got the new tinyurl.com?
Yeah, that's the address you want us to give out instead, right?
Both. But do this. Use two of them. tinyurl.com uppercase COPAD and then lowercase the rest of the name of that place.
There's no slash between COPA and Dallas?
Correct.
Oh, so it's COPA Dallas. Okay, just
yes.
One word.
Uppercase the first five letters, including the D.
Got it. Okay.
And then, you know, just because it's easy... Anyway, that address is actually spit back by tinyurl. You just give them a long address, and it immediately spits out the...
Our goal will be to get the minutes out around Monday or so. So if you
know, add to that address the following. Ready?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
PoliticalAssassinations.com.
PoliticalAssassinations.com?
PoliticalAssassinations.com.
Okay.
Which is the parent of the tinyurl. It's the parent. So the tinyurl redirects back to PoliticalAssassinations.com for the page at which you can register for the conference.
Oh, I see. People want to register. Okay.
Right, but it's easier to get there by tinyurl.
Mm-hmm.
But it automatically, you know, redirects back to the long address. But all you need is tinyurl.com/copadallas.
Okay.
So, but
we'll make sure that goes in the minutes. We'll make sure it goes in the minutes that way.
So political, besides politicalassassinations.com, cite the other ones as also valuable resources. Ready?
Okay.
OccupyTheGrassyKnoll.org. OccupyTheGrassyKnoll.org.
Okay, that's research.
And okay, jfkmurder.com. jfkmurder.com.
Anything in caps, sir?
No, just JFK Murder.
Okay.
Also, now, that site, jfkmurder.com, is the website of a man named Robert Groden. Robert Groden was the chief video
This is getting too detailed, okay? I mean, we just want things to point people to if they want more information. And we'll
right, but and that's what I'm giving you.
Yeah, okay, and we'll give them those website URLs.
Right, here's the thing, I'm trying to explain to you.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Groden is a key figure in the investigation of the case. He was the first one to make public the Zapruder film
mm-hmm.
on a public tour with Geraldo Rivera in 1975. 12 mm-hmm. years after the event took place, the public could not see the Zapruder film until Robert Groden went on the Geraldo show and made it public. For 12 years, it had been concealed. He became the video and photo consultant for the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 77, 78, and then he was employed as a consultant to Oliver Stone for the JFK movie. He was the photo and video, you know, consultant for the movie, including the enlargement of the Zapruder footage that shows the fatal headshot from the front. That's all Robert Groden's doing. This is his website, jfkmurder.com. The reason I'm telling you that little bit about him and his key significance to the whole matter is that if you go add to the list of referrals, the weekly paper, the weekly paper in Dallas is called dallasobserver.com. And in the search field, type in his name, because in every week's issue of the Dallas Observer for the past year have been articles about Robert Groden. So just say, go to dallasobserver.com, enter the name Robert Groden in the search field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you got that? And that's his site, jfkmurder.com. And I helped him personally move to Dallas 18 years ago. I helped him pack up his U-Haul truck in Philadelphia so he could move to Dallas and be the first person every day when tourists come to Dealey Plaza, where they flock from all over the world, and the first person they meet is Robert Groden. So he's been harassed by the city of Dallas for the past year.
He's maintaining a constant presence there, or what?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to tell you about Robert Groden. His birthday is November 22nd, 1946. November 22nd, 1946. So on his birthday, when he was 18, a senior in high school in Brooklyn, he got the news on his birthday of the execution in Dallas. And so because his main interest in high school was photography, you know, by the time he graduated, he became the guy, as I say, who made public the forensic evidence from the Zapruder film. He introduced it to the American public, but for the caveat that actually Jim Garrison had subpoenaed it to the trial in New Orleans, the Clay Shaw trial, you know, and so he'd subpoenaed it from Time Life magazine, who had the original, you know, thing. And so, but Robert Groden introduced it to the public when Jim Garrison only introduced it to the jury of the trial in New Orleans. But
uh-huh.
after that, it was still, you know, seven more years, and it was Robert Groden who went on tour with his Scooter film on the Geraldo show. I'm going to give you three more sites.
No, I can't right now. I'm outside right now. I've just got to get some fresh air. Sorry. I thought we were done. So if you
that after jfkmurder.com, direct people to dallasobserver.com and type in his name into the search field.
Well, yeah, if there's anything else you'd like me to add, just email it to me. I'll give you my email address, okay? You can just email it to me, and I'll add it to the list, okay?
All right, let me write it down and your phone.
Okay.
All right, I'm ready.
It's Diogenes, you know, just like the Greek figure, Diogenes.
Are you from Toledo?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm from East Lansing.
Oh, there you go. Same neck of the woods.
Yeah, what year? But you know what?
Well,
I went to high school in the Upper Peninsula.
Oh, a Uper, huh?
No, I moved there from East Lansing in the middle of eighth grade.
Uh-huh.
Just between JFK's election in November 1960 and his inaugural in 1961 in January. That's when I moved from East Lansing in December of 1960 to a village on Lake Superior. But the significance is that it was Toledo. The war, they had a war over Toledo.
Yeah, there's a great Toledo war, that's true.
Right. In fact, it was when I was in grade school in East Lansing, it was state law. It was state law that required all public school children in Michigan must know by the time they finish fifth grade the reason why our state, it's the only state in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to learn all about, you know, the Toledo Strip War.
Sure.
And the deal where Ohio got the mouth of the Maumee River. And Congress
right.
then carved up the Wisconsin territories, but
right.
since Wisconsin was yet a state for 20
that's,
more
that's
years.
That's how you all got the Upper Peninsula up there. That's right.
Right, and I moved there in the middle of eighth grade from East Lansing. So I went to high school in a little village on right smack. We had 1,000 feet of beach on Lake Superior in my backyard.
Yeah, well. As I recall, that's a pretty cold lake.
we called it Neo-Arctic.
Yeah.
Called it Neo-Arctic, but you can drink it.
Okay, let me give you my the rest of my email address there.
Yep.
So it's Diogenes and then Quest, Q-U-E-S-T. So Diogenes-Quest @gmail.com. My phone number is... 832.
You're in Houston?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm in Boston. I'm in Cambridge. Okay, 832?
Mm-hmm. 512?
So 832 and then 512.
Yep.
And this is a cell number?
Yeah, it's a cell number.
Yeah, we got a lot to talk about. I mean, besides...
And 4751.
Huh?
Well, what? You got the rest of it, 4751?
Okay, now I do 47. Yeah, I was mad at Paul. I said,
well, I understand that, but see, here's the thing.
I wasn't really mad.
I know, but here's the thing. The you and Paul have an interesting difference of opinion
yes.
that is well worth exploring. Now, it doesn't directly relate to 9/11, but there have been arguments in the past about the need to link 9/11 to the Kennedy assassination. So if you can figure out a way to sort of make your difference with Paul somewhat related to 9/11, I mean, we could devote, you know, like a half hour to 45 minutes
yeah.
to that on a conference call.
Well, I mean, it's embodied in Peter Dale Scott. He's the personification of that, along with John McMurtry.
What would you say?
The
well,
two of them
yeah, yeah.
are really the intellectual,
I agree. Especially McMurtry. McMurtry is he blows my socks off, man. I mean,
and
I'm meeting that guy.
And Michael Parenti.
Well, Michael Parenti's a friend of mine.
Also mine.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah,
well,
my mother died in Berkeley, and I was there for 3 weeks. And
mm-hmm.
and I spent a good part of my time with both Peter Dale Scott and Michael Parenti. And Gary Aguilar, by the way, an ophthalmologist in San Francisco, who's part of the I don't want to say ruling elite, of COPA. An ophthalmologist for a long time, mm-hmm. professor of ophthalmology at UC San Francisco branch is the medical complex.
Uh-huh.
Medical school, because in Berkeley they don't have the medical school, so instead
yeah.
they have it in San Francisco. And Gary Aguilar is a professor of ophthalmology, and I've been mm-hmm. to his office across the street from the medical school, and stayed at his house for a couple of nights. All this while, you know, my mother died in Berkeley, so I got to visit with all three of them, Gary and with Michael. I got to Michael's house, and he said, let's go sit on a bench in the park. So we went to
Michael and I spent some time in Yugoslavia right after the war, right after the U.S. war there. We were on a mission to collect evidence about the civilian targeting there in association with the National Action Center, now called other things, Answer or whatever, but at that time it was called the National Action Center. And former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark was compiling, you know, some evidence.
He was in Boston. He was here at the Harvard Law School 3 days ago.
Sorry, I just lost my earpiece there.
I was standing. Ramsey Clark spoke on a panel at the Harvard Law School 3 days ago.
Oh, yeah. How's he doing, man? How's his health?
I didn't go. He didn't go.
Oh, okay.
But I know that, I mean, someone called me, or I was advised by someone who knows.
Well, he's getting on in years, man. That guy's, he's a piece of history, you know, and
It includes, though, his tenure in the White House.
Yeah.
As Attorney General for both JFK and LBJ. That's no less part of the history than association with International Action Center or Workers' World, for that matter.
Right. Well, he isn't actually directly connected with Workers' World. He's just sort of a front for them.
Never really come clean about his role as chair of what it was called the Clark Panel. It was a medical review. You know, it had to do with evidence from JFK's autopsy. And he's never really come clean about, and I'd have to dig it up, but, I mean, there were whole books about the Clark Panel that most people never heard of, but while he was yet still Attorney General under LBJ, you know, came issues relating to the autopsy. The autopsy, I mean, it was a military, it was an illegal military, you know, under military protocol, where the medical examiner in Dallas had jurisdiction. And the medical examiner in Dallas, who had jurisdiction, was threatened at gunpoint by the Secret Service, who stole.
What was Clark's role? Clark had a commission to examine this, or what?
Yes. Well, I mean, he was chair I'd have to research it, but I can tell you who wrote a book about it. If you really want to go after it. But I mean, it's part of the Ramsey Clark history, and it's been whitewashed.
I sure wasn't aware of it. Yeah, you're right.
Well, so the author you're looking for is now deceased. One of the first, you know, wave of critics of the fairy tale about Oswald was Harold Weisberg. And write that down. And he wrote a series that you can buy from Amazon called Whitewash. There were a series of about, you know, Whitewash 2, Whitewash 3, Whitewash 4, Whitewash 5, I don't know, at least four of them. And one of those books is dedicated to a expose about the Clark Panel regarding medical evidence. You could look it up by that name. You know, just look up look up, you don't even have...
Is this stuff all online or what?
Well, Harold Weisberg, because of the recent plethora of new publications about the coup d'etat, because there's so many new ones, that his sort of gets lost in the shuffle because it was 1967, 1968. He was a professional. He was an investigator for the Justice Department, and not Ramsey Clark. Who am I talking about? Harold Weisberg. Harold Weisberg. Did you write that down?
No, but I'll remember it. Harry Weisberg.
Oh, not Harry. Harold.
Harold Weisberg. W-E-I-S-S-B-E-R-G.
Except it's only one S.
Okay.
And the title, Whitewash.
Okay.
And you'll find articles about it, but you'll also find Amazon, you know, pages where you can buy it. But one of those in particular, as I recall, was a specific repudiation of the Clark panel.
And so Clark has been confronted subsequently regarding this, and he hasn't come clean. Is that what you're saying, too?
I would say it's more that there have been sparse occasions where that might have been possible, but that it's not the issue of who or when or whether someone has confronted him. And then
whether he volunteered it. Yeah, okay.
And in fact, I've seen interviews of him published by people, you know, who rode in a cab with him or something at the airport, or others who talked to him at greater length. And the consensus is, you know, from what he says about his role at the time as Attorney General under Johnson, that essentially, you know, there's nothing wrong with the conclusion of the Warren Commission. And that in itself is highly suspect.
Yeah.
Because it's no less transparent than, you know, two planes and three towers.
Yeah.
It's no less transparent. I mean, the whole magic bullet business, it's so transparent and so, you know, blatant that it's not only is do the matters that we're under discussion here are in parallel, but more importantly, the execution that is the pulling off of the orchestration of 9/11 can be well understood as having been achieved more or less by the same gang who murdered President Kennedy. And Obama is merely the current face of it all.
Yeah, well, we know that. That's
right. But I mean, what is he the face of? But as Wayne Madsen helps us understand, that his childhood in Jakarta was made financially feasible from the employment of his mother and stepfather in the commission of. In other words, their complicity in the genocide enabled the means by which they could afford the costs of Barack Obama's childhood in Jakarta. But the more important thing yet is that all of this could only have occurred over JFK's body. It could not have happened except on the predicate of the coup d'etat.
Well, I heard you say that earlier tonight, and I think, you know, I agree with your conclusion, but that's just one of many things that could not have happened without his death.
Could not have happened without his death. He was murdered in order to make that happen. The cancellation of policies and instructions that he had instituted had to be diametrically canceled and reversed. And that's why he was murdered. It's not that it had to do with, it was executed for that purpose, in order to reverse his policy.
Right. Right, we know that, but there are other policies that had to be reversed that were reversed too.
Not only Indonesia, yes, but that was part of it. And what matters there is simply the fact of Obama's history as a front man for the CIA. I mean, up to this current point, as their, you know, their face, and for which he's been groomed since his childhood. Whose cost of everything that it entailed, his cost of living and enrollment in schools in Jakarta, which had to be in the name of, as Wayne Madsen informs us and documents, in the name of Barry Sotoro. Because that was the stepfather's name. And she had gone back to Honolulu, and as Wayne Madsen informs us, when she went back to Honolulu, she left Barack in the custody of Lolo. And what was Lolo's, you know, business? What did he do for a living? He was a mass murderer under supervision of the Ford, in the pay of the Ford Foundation, supervision of the CIA and the Indonesian Army. He was a general who orchestrated genocide. And from that income enabled the cost of Barack Obama's childhood. So what I'm getting at is correlation. Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
What I'm getting at is the correlation, the Wayne Mason doesn't touch this, but it's true. The correlation between the ascension of Barack Obama and the means by which the costs of his childhood were enabled over JFK's dead body.
And you're saying that that's highly documented, right?
Well, we'll take one side at a time, because the Obama part is brought to us by Wayne Mattson, who's been on the teleconference, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he'll be in Dallas to boot. I talked to him the other day. Wayne Mattson mm-hmm. is coming. And right there is this, you know, should be the discussion of, you know, where do all these pieces of the puzzle, you know, fit together. But the fulcrum mm-hmm. is the president's murder, right on the right mm-hmm. the right temple, just above his right eye. And that, whoever pulled the trigger, and, you know, we don't pretend to know who pulled the trigger, whereas in the case of Memphis, we know who pulled the trigger. Memphis police officer, Lieutenant Earl Clark.
Yeah, the recent book, I can't remember
William Pepper.
No, the recent book on the JFK assassination, the guy does claim to identify the murderer.
Oh, who do you mean, Jim Douglas? What book? There's hundreds of them, Ken.
I know, but this is recent. This is very recent.
I know, but there's dozens of them. Dozens of them that are coming out, you know, hot off the press. And a lot of them are flagrant deception. You know, like James Reston from the New York Times has a new book. I can't get over it. A new book is that Oswald missed his target and hit John Kennedy by accident because he was really aiming at John Connolly, governor of Texas.
Oh, jeez.
That's what he said. And whereas there's no evidence that Oswald ever fired a weapon.
Or that he had a motive, for that matter.
Right, right. So what's the point of, you know, analyzing or psychoanalyzing the motive of an innocent guy? It had nothing to do with the murder, except as the scapegoat in his case. They could not have, you know, pulled it off. And it was that he was being framed for 3 years.
What's the name of Douglas's book?
Oh, JFK and the Unspeakable.
No, that's an old book. That's been around for quite a long time.
Oh, it came out in 2008. No,
yeah.
It came out in 08.
I'm talking about a book that came out within the last 3 months.
Well, but again, Ken, there's lots of them. So.
Okay, all right.
But I would go to Robert Groden's site. He specializes in photographic evidence, because that's mm-hmm. what he did. And he was born on November 22nd, 1946, and his 18th birthday was the assassination. So he just catapulted his serious interest in cameras and photography and wound up the leading photo and video expert in the country about the vision, you know, the photo and video evidence from Dealey Plaza. He's the number one man, and that's whose site is it. That's jfkmurder.com. And that's why when I said go to dallasobserver.com and type in his name, for the chronicle of incidents where he's been cited 83 times in the past year on a complaint by the Dallas police that he was vending in a city park without a permit. I just watched an interview of him by a television reporter in Medford, Oregon. Somebody up in Medford, he just told me, I was talking to him the other day, he said he had an audience of 500 in the town of Medford, Oregon. So there's a YouTube clip of Robert Groden. You could find it, where he's telling the interviewer on local television that he's been cited 83 times on a charge of vending in a city park without a permit. And then he explains, number one, it's not a city park. It's a federal landmark, not a Dallas city park. And number two, there's no legislation or any municipal ordinance that would forbid vending on Dealey Plaza. Or, you know, they just don't have that in their ordinances. In their statutory language, they don't say you can't vend, you know, what's that? That's a federal landmark. there is no such legislation, but they've cited him, nonetheless, 83 times. And one time, they locked him up, and then in jail for 9 hours, denied him his medications. He's 68 years old, and for 18 years, since I helped him pack his U-Haul truck in Philadelphia, so he could move to Dallas where every day for 18 years, he's at his little table, greeting the tourists on Dealey Plaza, on the grassy knoll. So I don't know if I missed when I told you the list of address, but don't forget occupythegrassyknoll.org.
Okay. Well, it's been interesting talking with you, Lenny. I've got to run, but...
So I'll try to email you some more links. And
also see if you can't figure out a way to pose the difference between you and Paul in a way that we can put it as an item on the agenda for a future call and see if you can go at it, okay?
It's a very complex and very nuanced discussion. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is I wanted to draw people's attention to the opportunity of registering and attending this conference.
Yeah, well, we'll get that out by Monday. By Monday or Tuesday, we'll get that out so people can see that. The whole invitation list will see that, okay?
Okay, including the better URL, the tiny URL,
.com/Copa Dallas. Right, absolutely.
And you'll check it out yourself, I hope.
Yeah, I'll take a look at it. Mm-hmm.
All right, and there's more, but we'll talk again another time soon, I hope.
Okay, let me take care.
All right, from Toledo to Lansing.
Bye-bye.
All right, thanks, Ken. Over and out.